Of its own, we call ourselves, or some of us, I don't, but some of us call ourselves string theorists. And yet, the connection between string theory and physics, either elementary particle physics, or cosmology, or even condensed matter physics, but we're not interested in that, seems to be lacking. Nobody seems to quite know what it is. We hear a lot from our condensed matter friends and our other, well, they're not really our friends, but they complain, and of course we tell them to go about their business, we're smarter than they are, and but between ourselves, when we're together and we've had maybe a drink or two and we're sitting down and talking about things, we do wonder, why is it that we've made such little progress? Why is it that we haven't understood how to really make this theory confront nature? And by nature, I mean elementary particle physics, and I mean cosmology. And we should worry about it. It's not that I personally think the theory is wrong. I certainly don't think it's wrong. I think it's probably right in some appropriate sense. But nevertheless, why is it? How could it possibly be around for that long, and yet no progress made, really no progress made, in definitively understanding the connection with particles and the connection with cosmology? Well, I think the answer might be that we've had the wrong ideas up till now about what the theory should do. We've had the wrong expectations for the theory. We've had the wrong idea about the kind of theory it is, and so we've tried to push it into a mold that was wrong. That's what my lectures are going to be about for the most part. I was thinking of talking about string theory and De Sitter space, but unfortunately, up till now, there is no such subject as string theory. Well, there's a little bit of a subject, and I'll talk a little bit about it. But before we can really understand how string theory should fit together with, and I'm going to think about cosmology for the most part, I think we have to know a little bit more about the foundations of cosmology, what cosmology should look like, what the basic principles of it are. And for my money, I think one of the most important things we have to understand is the problem of the cosmological constant and the problem of De Sitter space. What is De Sitter space? How does it fit into fundamental physics? Does it fit into string theory? Is it a possible solution of string theory? And if not, what do we make out of it? So that's what my lectures are going to be about. And the subject really doesn't really quite exist. It's something we're sort of making up right now, and it's being made up in only a very small number of places. So what I'm going to tell you may not be the ultimate answer to these questions about the De Sitter space and so forth, but I'm going to tell you as much as I understand. So let me now stand up. Now I have to stand up. I lost my doodad. So we're going to begin with basically what... that's awful. What is De Sitter space? And talk a little bit about its quantum mechanics, and then start to speculate a little bit about how the right way to think about the quantum mechanics of De Sitter space is, and then enter into some deep cosmological speculations, and in particular, how string theory should be properly used in understanding nature. Okay, so let's begin with spaces with horizons. I need a pointer. Is there a pointer? I prefer a laser pointer, but I'll take anything up to a baseball bat.
I've got a laser pointer.
Oh, good. Good. Only my lecture today, I imagine mostly my lecture today will be on view graphs. After that, I'll use the blackboard. Okay, so... this is awful. I don't have the first transparency. Can't find transparency one. Simeon, did you?
Oh, is that it on the...
Oh, yes, that's it right there. Thank you. All right, so let's begin with lecture one. Lecture one is spaces with horizons. De Sitter space is a special case of a space with a horizon. And so we're going to write down a general theory of spaces with horizons. We've all seen the Schwarzschild metric, We've all seen all sorts of black hole metrics, and they're almost always written in the form the S squared is equal to some function of radial position times dt squared, 1 over F, the R squared, and then minus R squared times some spherical factor. Incidentally, this form is not necessarily 3 plus 1 dimension, but I'm going to restrict my attention, or at least my language, to using 3 plus 1 dimensional notation. Why, when I move it this way, does it move that way? Oh, it's because there's a mirror in there. Okay, so let's start with a metric, and I'll call this the standard form. It's the standard form for a static, non-time-dependent solution of Einstein's equations. And f of r is essentially the one function that comes into it. It's basically the gravitational potential, and it obeys an equation similar to the gravitational potential. Basically, del squared f is equal to the energy density. All right. Now, in general, we'll find that f is a function which may or may not have a zero in it. If it has a zero, and in particular if it has a linear zero, if it vanishes at some point, that point is a horizon. Special case would be Schwarzschild black holes and other black holes, and I'll give you some examples as we go along. But I'm interested in analyzing the structure of the space in the vicinity of the horizon. I want to do near horizon physics. Okay? So let's define rho to be the proper distance from the point r equals r naught, the spatial point r equals r naught. This is a spatial separation, and it satisfies d rho is equal to dr over the square root of f here, and writing in the square root of f approximately in the near horizon region, we can integrate that equation and find out that proper distance from the horizon varies as the square root of the difference between the radial parameters r and r naught. Or to solve it, we can write r minus r naught is proportional to the same constant c times rho squared, rho being the proper distance from the horizon, and there's a factor of 4 which comes into it. The near horizon geometry, which means we simply plug in these near horizon values, the near horizon geometry then always looks as follows. We define a tau, which is this constant, same constant, divided by 2, times the time, t. Plug it back in here, and we always find minus rho squared d tau squared plus d rho squared plus rho squared d omega 2 squared. But if we're in the near horizon region, then we might as well just put this in as the this is r naught squared, not rho naught squared, r naught squared. It's just the coefficient here evaluated at the horizon position. That's the near horizon geometry of a wide class of systems with horizons, almost all of them. Okay, tau is c over 2, and that's its definition. Now, this geometry here, if we look at just the rho tau part of the geometry, it has a very, very simple form. Minus rho squared d tau squared plus d rho squared. What is it? It's just good old two-dimensional Minkowski space written in a kind of polar coordinate form. Not polar coordinates in the sense of rotations, but polar coordinates in the sense of Lorentz transformation. In other words, tau is a hyperbolic angle, and rho is a radial distance. So what we found is that the near horizon geometry is simply ordinary Minkowski space, except expressed in a form using radial and polar coordinates. To see this connection with ordinary polar coordinates, we can make an analytic continuation of time to time I times time, or I times this tau variable here, call it theta, and this geometry just becomes good old flat space, flat Euclidean space in polar coordinates. This part doesn't play much role for now. In particular, it means that theta is a periodic variable, an angle variable. That's the character of all near horizon geometries, except for the special cases of certain extremal geometries, which are very, very special cases, and I won't play any role in what we're going to talk about. Now, since theta, which is the imaginary time, let's just call it the imaginary time, is periodic with period 2 pi, that indicates that the system is thermal. I'm going to assume that everybody knows that in quantum mechanics, to study a thermal system, all you have to do is make the time imaginary and periodic. The period determines the temperature. All right, now there are various temperatures that come up, various definitions of temperature, and I'll tell you what they are. If we use tau, or hyperbolic angle, as our time parameter, then there's a temperature which goes with that. In fact, there's a temperature which goes with every definition of time. The reason is the following. Temperature has units of energy, I d by d time. And if temperature has units of energy, and we change time variables, we always change energy variables in inverse proportion. So if there's a time variable tau, there's a Hamiltonian that goes with it, I d by d tau, and a temperature that goes with it. This is just changes of units. I'm talking about nothing but changes of units. But in particular, the variable tau that I defined was dimensionless. It didn't even have the dimensions of a time. It was a hyperbolic angle. It was dimensionless. There's a dimensionless temperature that goes with it, and that dimensionless temperature is just 1 over 2 pi, the inverse of the period of that time-like variable. Okay? That's generally true, that the temperature is just the inverse of the periodicity associated with a time variable. Now, there's another time variable that I could use. Let me go out to a particular radial separation from the horizon. Let's call it rho. Move out away from the origin to distance rho. And instead of using dimensionless time, let's use proper time of an observer at that distance. The connection between these two temperatures is just through a simple transformation, a Jacobian. The temperature in S units, proper units, is the temperature in dimensionless units times d tau by ds. And if you remember, d tau by ds was just 1 over rho with the metric that we have. And so the proper temperature, it's the temperature measured by a thermometer located a distance rho from the horizon, that will measure a temperature 1 over 2 pi rho. That's true for every geometry which has a horizon and I will stop saying this after a while, except for those which are associated with extremal black holes. So we have a temperature which seems to diverge as we get closer and closer to the horizon. That's one characteristic of this temperature. And it diminishes as we move away from the horizon, like 1 over the distance to the horizon. Finally, there's the temperature measured in the same units that we chose for our original time variable in the original metric. Right? That's t sub tau times d tau by dt. And if you go back to the equation that I had before, which I probably lost by now, that's just c, the parameter c, I'll remind you what it is in a moment, divided by 4 pi. C was the coefficient of the linear zero in the function f. Remember, it was f of r, and f went to zero like r minus r naught times, or r minus r naught times c. So, and that we'll call the Hawking temperature. It's the temperature measured in the original units that I chose to express the metric in terms of. All right, let's do some examples. Let's do some examples to see what kind of things we get. First of all, let's do the conventional Schwarzschild, four-dimensional Schwarzschild black hole. For that case, f of r is just 1 minus 2mg over r. Incidentally, you can understand that as follows. I told you that f of r basically satisfies the equation for a potential, for a gravitational potential. Del squared f of r is equal to a point source at the origin. The solution to that is a constant, and then a term which goes like 1 over r. Just good old Newtonian gravity. Just put in good old Newtonian gravity. That will give you the right answer. And so f of r is just 1 minus 2mg over r. But near the horizon is at r equals 2mg. This is just r minus 2mg over 2mg. And so now we can see that the quantity r naught, that's the position of the horizon, is just at 2mg. That's called the Schwarzschild radius. And the parameter c, the parameter c was the coefficient of this linear zero here. That's just 1 over 2mg. From that, we can read off the Hawking temperature, c over 4 pi, and it's just 1 over 8 pi times the mass of the black hole times the Newtonian constant g. Okay? So that's a specific particular example of geometry with a horizon. It's the most famous one, of course. Now, given that the black hole has energy, it has mass, just E equals mc squared, it has energy, therefore, it has energy and it has temperature, then according to the standard rules of thermodynamics, it will also have an entropy. The standard definition of entropy is simply through the formula that the change in energy, the differential change in energy, is temperature times the differential change in entropy. There's nothing else to vary in this problem. There's no volume to vary, nothing else. And so this is the only thing in the, what is this called, the first law of thermodynamics? I don't know, it's the first, it's not the second, it's some law of thermodynamics. And if we plug in for the energy of the black hole, its mass, and we plug in for the Hawking temperature, 1 over 8 pi mg, then we will find that there's an entropy content, and the entropy content is 4 pi, solving this equation, 4 pi m squared g. So there's an entropy. What the entropy means is another question, but for the moment we find there's an entropy. And now if we plug in what the Schwarzschild radius is, twice mg, we will find the famous formula that the entropy of the black hole is the area divided by 4 times the Newton constant. Now, this formula appears to be very, very general, far more general than I've explained here. It seems to be so general that it's true in higher dimensions. Now, what on earth does an area mean in higher dimensions? Well, it means the surface of one less dimension than the dimension of space, whatever it is. If you're in 52 dimensions, then there are 51 space dimensions, and an area is 50-dimensional. 50, did I say that right? I think so, yes. All right, so the area simply means the volume of the d minus 2 dimensional hypersurface that defines the horizon. And 4g, the g is just the Newton constant that goes into the coefficient of the curvature in the Einstein-Lagrangian, the standard Newtonian constant. And this formula is extremely general. Let's take the case of 2 plus 1 dimensions. In 2 plus 1 dimensions, area just becomes linear length. A horizon, if it existed, would be a line instead of a surface, instead of a membrane, or instead of a two-dimensional surface. And in that case, the Newtonian constant has slightly different dimensions than it has in 3 plus 1 dimensions. It has units of 1 over a mass, and you wind up with the correct kind of thing for... there's some h-bar in there also. Incidentally, if you actually follow the h-bars, there's an h-bar in the numerator of the temperature. So temperature is a quantum effect. But the h-bar in the entropy is in the denominator. I didn't write it in, but it's in there. It's in the denominator, area over 4g h-bar next to g here. And that means entropy is not in itself a quantum thing. The fact that the entropy is finite instead of infinite is the quantum thing. If h-bar went to zero, the entropy wouldn't go away. It would diverge. It means to say that a black hole in the classical limit has infinite entropy, and it's quantum mechanics that makes the entropy finite. Keep that in mind always when you think about black holes and entropy. All right, now, this morning we heard a little bit about Penrose diagrams. I think Professor Wood actually had this Penrose diagram on the blackboard, if I wasn't mistaken. This is the Penrose diagram, and I won't define a Penrose diagram. It was very nicely done this morning. But let me just explore it a little bit. The singularity of the black hole, which is at r equals zero in the Schwarzschild metric, that's a space-like surface, and it's a space-like surface because it's behind the horizon. And in fact, there are two of them. The full analytic completion of the Schwarzschild metric has two singularities, one in the past and one in the future. It has this strangely doubled physical, let's call it the physical region, the region outside the black hole. This is the region outside the black hole, and these lines here represent the coordinate chart built out of ordinary Schwarzschild coordinates. It was shown this morning, and I don't need to show it again. One interesting question is, what is this other half doing there? What's the physics of this other half? Why is there another half there? And why is there a past singularity when, after all, when we make a black hole, we only expect a future singularity? We'll address those questions a little bit. Another drawing that you can make is to take the RT, where is it? The RT geometry. It's not on here. Take the RT geometry, but the Euclidean RT geometry. Remember what the Euclidean geometry was near the horizon? It was a plane expressed in polar coordinates. The very near horizon geometry here, that's right at the tip of the cigar, is locally a plane. It's a smooth tip of a cigar, very smooth, sort of like a sphere, capped off by a sphere. It's in polar coordinates, and these polar coordinates are imaginary time. The RT geometry, as you move away from the black hole center, away from the horizon, takes on the form of a long cigar, a semi-infinite cigar, it's sometimes called, going off to R equals infinity. And it's only near the tangent plane to the tip here that, of course, it looks like a flat plane with polar coordinates. So that's, oh, there's one other diagram that I should, can we raise that up? Anybody know how to do this? No, no, not that one. That one stays. I want to raise this one up. They're electric. Sit down. Okay. There's one other diagram which is useful to have in the back of your mind. This picture over here, the semi-infinite cigar, is not a space slice through the geometry. It's space-time, only the RT plane, and in Euclidean continuation. Another thing you can do is slice through a space-like surface right through the center here and ask what it looks like. And I'm going to show you what it looks like. You start out far away. That's R equals infinity. I'm going to draw it as if it were 2 plus 1 dimensions instead of 3 plus 1 dimensions. And you start moving in. As you move in, the two sphere that's at each point gets smaller and smaller and smaller. Okay? It's infinite out here. It gets smaller and smaller until you get to the horizon. At that point, the two sphere is the size of the horizon. And then if you keep going, it expands out again. So the geometry, the spatial geometry of a section through the symmetry plane of the black hole looks like this. All right, this would just be flat space if there was no black hole. Here's another copy of flat space on the left here, but they're obviously connected. You can move right through here. You can't move through there unless you exceed the speed of light, but just imagine moving through here, and it looks like this. It's called an Einstein-Rosen bridge, and it's a wormhole or a Wheeler wormhole or whatever. And so the geometry at time t equals 0, let's think of it as time t equals 0, is two flat spaces with a neck between them. Okay. So that's the geometry of a Schwarzschild black hole. Let me give you one more example. Well, I'll give you a couple more examples before we go on to this. One more before we go to De Sitter space. The next one is an anti-De Sitter space black hole in three dimensions, just for variety. I'm not going to work out the metric for you. This corresponds, I'll tell you what it corresponds to. It corresponds to a negative cosmological constant, gives you anti-De Sitter space. And now you put a black hole into the anti-De Sitter space. For those who care about such things, this is a black brain actually in Poincaré coordinates. But that's not the interesting thing here. It's just the form of the metric has the usual form, the standard form, this, inverse of this, minus r squared, and this is 2 plus 1 dimensional, so the horizon becomes a line parameterized by a angle. Okay, this is just anti-De Sitter space by itself. Excuse me, this is just anti-De Sitter space by itself with nothing in it. Anti-De Sitter space with a black hole, the zero of this function moves out to point R naught. Here the zero was at R equals zero. That's not a black hole. That's just an ordinary polar coordinate geometry. Here, the zero has moved out to position R naught, the true horizon. And this is the form of the metric. Same form as the standard form. And this time we can read off that the constant C is twice r naught over r squared. R-naught is just R-naught, right? That's the place where the metric vanishes. C is the linear coefficient of that vanishing. It's twice R-naught over R-squared. And we can read off the Hawking temperature of it. It's R-naught over pi R-squared. If we are willing to assume that the area law is a very general law of nature, that entropy is proportional to area divided by 4g, then we could invert the little exercise I did before. And instead of calculating the entropy from the energy, we could use the dE equals TdS to calculate the energy in terms of the either the entropy or the temperature, and we would get some particular formula. The formula is not particularly important, just the logic of it. We use a little bit of thermodynamics in this case. We start with the area formula for entropy and work back to the energy formula for mass or for energy of the Schwarzschild anti-de Sitter black hole. All right, we're not going to dwell on that. The only thing about it which is interesting for me right now is that the Penrose diagram is a square this time. Instead of having the scry plus and scry minus out here, it simply has a time-like boundary. That would also be true of the pure anti-de Sitter space. It has a time-like boundary, but it actually has two boundaries, one associated with one half of the Schwarzschild diagram, the other associated with what's sometimes thought of as the unphysical end of things. It has a singularity on top and a singularity on bottom, and it's a square. A square means that a light signal could go from here to here. That's what it means. A light signal goes from there to there, 45 degrees. The Euclidean section of it looks also like a cigar. The boundary is actually at an infinite proper distance, but it's also at a finite causal distance. I'll tell you what the difference is. To say that it's a finite proper distance away just means you measure with meter sticks along a space-like surface, and you find out that you squeeze an infinite number of meter sticks between here and here. However, you can do something else. You can send a light signal from one point to another and ask how long it takes to reflect back. It takes a finite time to reflect back, and so there's this causal sense in which the boundary is not at infinity, in which the boundary appears as if it were a finite distance away. And if you draw it into the Euclidean section this way, then it just looks like a cigar that's been chopped with a boundary. Okay, so those are some black holes. Those are some example black holes. Let's now come to de Sitter space. So let me start with de Sitter space. By going at things backward. Instead of starting with a metric and deriving the Euclidean geometry associated with it and so forth, let me start with the Euclidean geometry. Why? I'll tell you why. What is de Sitter space? De Sitter space is the solution of Einstein's equations with a positive cosmological constant. It's not the only solution, but it's the most symmetric solution. And in fact, Einstein's equations says that the geometry has constant curvature everywheres. What would you expect? And constant positive curvature, positive in a particular definition of the term positive. Positive means greater than zero, but curvature can sometimes be defined with either a plus sign or a minus sign. I'm defining it so that the de Sitter space has positive curvature. Then the Euclidean section can only be a sphere. What else can it be? It has constant curvature everywhere. It's Euclidean geometry. There's only one such geometry, and it's the sphere with positive curvature, and that's it. So we can start now with the Euclidean geometry. Let me define the radius of the sphere to be r, and I'll also call it 1 over h. The h, incidentally, will play the role of the Hubble constant in the de Sitter space, and it's also true that the connection between h and the cosmological constant is just lambda over 3. H squared is lambda over 3 times g, just for a future reference. Okay, now let's start with a two-sphere. In fact, let's start with a two-sphere and write the metric for the two-sphere. Alpha is an angle which is longitude. Beta is an angle which is latitude, distance from the pole, or actually distance from the equator. The metric for a two-sphere, here she is right here, the alpha squared plus cosine squared alpha d beta squared. And if we want to generalize this to higher dimensions, it's very simple. The beta is an angle which runs, let's see, which way does it run? Alpha's longitude, so alpha runs this way, beta runs this way. This, you replace the beta squared by the metric of a d minus one dimensional sphere. Okay, that's the, and I'll do that from time to time, give you the answer for a two-dimensional system and then tell you how you generalize it to a higher dimensional system. Okay, now let's make an analytic continuation to get to Minkowski space. The first analytic continuation, number one, is just to let alpha be I times tau, okay, and let tau equal I t over r. Tau is dimensionless because it's an angle, or alpha is an angle, but t has dimensions of time, and it's scaled by the radius of the sphere altogether. And if we work it out, we'll simply find out that ds squared is minus dt squared plus r squared, not cosine, but cosh squared of t over r, times the same metric of the d minus one sphere. Okay, so this is the Sitter space expressed in Friedman-Robertson-Walker form with positive spatial curvature. Positive spatial curvature refers to the fact that the d minus one sphere is positively curved. There are other ways to write this, in which it can look in a number of different ways, but for the moment, this is the way we'll write it. And now, let's see what we can find out. First of all, this is Friedman-Robertson-Walker with a scale factor, which is r times cosh. And for t over r much greater than 1, absolute value of t over r, it's exponentially increasing in size. It exponentially blows up. The scale factor goes as exponential of t over r. And we can calculate the Hubble parameter. By definition, the Hubble parameter is a dot over a. And that's just given by 1 over r here. So we see that, in fact, r is the inverse of the Hubble parameter. Now, this geometry was a sphere. The Minkowski version of it is a hyperboloid, obviously. And one thing that's immediately obvious about the Sitter space is that it's not static. It's a bounce. Stuff comes in, or the geometry decreases and increases and bounces, and there's nothing static about it. So it would seem surprising to think about thermodynamic concepts in such a geometry. Thermodynamic concepts make sense when things are static, not when they're rapidly moving. Nevertheless, are there any questions at this point? Good. Am I going too fast? No, okay. Now let's go back to the two-dimensional case again. It's useful for visualization. Let's go back to the two-dimensional case and return to we didn't return. We never departed from the global description of it. Write the metric again. Here it is. In the two-dimensional case is an angle beta. In other words, the d minus one sphere is replaced by beta. And let's define a coordinate by du equals d tau over cosh tau. In other words, I'm changing time variables from tau to u in just such a way that the metric takes the form of a universal factor multiplying du squared and d beta squared. This, of course, is a conformally flat form of the metric. In this form, in terms of the u beta plane, light signals move with 45 degrees. That's the significance of going to conformal coordinates. Light signals, in other words, ds equals 0 is the same as du equals plus or minus d beta. Light signals in the u beta plane propagate on obvious light cones, 45 degree light cones. And the scale factor comes out and multiplies the whole thing like this. Now, what is the range of u? Tau goes from minus infinity to infinity. Tau goes from minus infinity to infinity from the bottom of the hyperboloid to the top of the hyperboloid, but u will have a range which is just given by this integral, d tau from minus infinity to infinity over cosh tau, and that's completely convergent at both ends. And so the range of variation of u is finite, and in fact, if you work it out, it goes from either minus pi, it goes a range pi. So it goes from minus pi to pi, or from minus pi to zero. I like from minus pi to zero better. That's the range of u, but the range of beta is 2 pi. Beta is an angle that goes all the ways around the sphere, and so the range of beta is 2 pi. So reduced to conformal coordinates in this manner, the geometry is a rectangle. Well, it's not really a rectangle. This side is identified with this side, so it's actually a piece of a cylinder. And the cylinder has a height which is exactly half of its circumference. This means, for example, that you could send a light ray from this point to this point and a light ray from this point to this point. That's the invariant significance of saying that its height is half of its circumference. Or another way to think of it is you could send a light signal from one point all the ways around the universe to the other side if you sent two light rays and they would just converge at the end of time, so to speak. This horizontal line is the end of time, very large tau. This is the beginning of time, very, very remote past future. And beta goes from either 0 to 2 pi or minus pi to pi, depending on your taste. That's the conformal structure of two-dimensional De Sitter space. Now, as I said, there's nothing about this geometry which looks static. There's nothing about it which looks like you might want to think about it in terms of thermodynamics. On the other hand, I will now show you another continuation of the geometry which gives rise to a static geometry. Here again is the sphere. Instead of using, in the previous case, time, or imaginary time, was just height above the South Pole here. How high up you are, what latitude you're at. Now I'm going to use longitude for time. I'm going to make an analytic continuation, not alpha goes to I tau, but beta goes to I tau. If I do that, the metric now takes the form r squared minus cosine squared alpha, same thing, times d tau squared plus d alpha squared. So digest that for a minute, and then we'll make some simple change of variables. Just again, to make time have units of time instead of dimensionless, we'll scale it by the radius of the sphere itself. That's trivial. That's just redefining it so it now has units of time. But now little r I'm going to define to be big R times sine of alpha. Okay, use the fact that cos squared alpha is 1 minus little r squared over big R squared, and you put it back into the metric, and guess what? You find the metric in the form, the standard form, I call it the standard form, of a static metric, 1 minus little r squared over big R squared times dt squared, same factor in the denominator over here, plus r squared times the d minus 2 sphere. So it takes exactly the same standard general form as other geometries, other static geometries with horizons. We've taken a geometry which was this bounce geometry and continued it a different way. It's actually the same geometry, as we'll see, a piece of the same geometry, but it has now been written in a way which makes it static, which makes it look static. And it is static, this piece of it. All right, we can calculate, if we like, the r naught. That's just the place that little r naught is big R. It's the R at which the prefactor here vanishes, where F vanishes. That locates the horizon for us at R equals big R. The coefficient of the linear zero here is just 2 over big R. And from that, we can compute both the entropy in terms of the area, in terms of the area of the sphere with radius capital R, that's the entropy, and the temperature, just from the formula that it's C over 4 pi, and that gives us the Hubble rate, the Hubble constant, 1 over big R, H is 1 over big R, H over 2 pi. Yes?
I'm not sure I understand. What's the physics? I mean, how come you became such a is it only a slice of the sitter space that we are looking at using its coordinates, or is it, the question is, what the physics can it move?
We'll come to it. You're asking, how did we get from a highly non-static geometry to a static one? Right.
What am I measuring?
We'll draw the whole thing on a single diagram, and you'll see how things are being sliced up. I'll show you several ways to think about it. But one way of saying it, we've used a time variable now, which is the analytic continuation of the longitude. And the longitude, one longitude is like every other longitude. You know, where you are, east, west, that was hard. That's why they write books now about how people discovered how to figure out what longitude was. Latitude was easy, height above the equator. Longitude, that's a symmetry direction. And moving from one longitude to another, nothing happens. That's the static character when you slice the geometry by longitude. Incidentally, when you slice the sphere, the horizons are actually the two points, the polar coordinate singularities. Once again, the horizon is the polar coordinate singularity. There are two of them, one over here and one over here, as we'll see. And a time slice through it is just a fixed longitude. Now, there's a dotted line in the back of the sphere that has a different longitude than the solid line in the front of the sphere. One of them is zero, the other is pi. So the backside of the sphere, the dotted line here, is a different time, a different imaginary time than the front side. The horizon divides the space, and the horizon divides the spatial sections, in this manner here, always into two pieces. This is just a two-dimensional drawing, so there's a half circle here, but in general it's a hemisphere and another hemisphere which are separated by a horizon. We'll see lots of drawings, you'll get familiar with this, that the spatial geometry of the sitter space at an instant of time is composed of two half spheres like this. Okay, now, yeah.
Now, little r must be when between 0 and big R, right?
Yeah.
So it seems you are only on one side of the horizon. Always.
That's right. That's correct. Yes. You're absolutely right. This parameterization is only parameterizing one side of the horizon. That's correct. And it's only it's parameterizing. Well, it's obviously a kind of disk or a solid ball. It's R goes from 0 to capital R. I should have mentioned that. In this parameterization, little r can only go from 0 to capital R, and when it does so, at capital R, it finds the horizon. That's where the horizon is. So here's an observer at r equals 0, little r equals 0, and here's the horizon at little r equals capital R. That's the nature of the geometry at a fixed instant of time. One more comment. Actually, let me forget that for a moment. Now let's put it together and see if we can understand the full geometry and its relationship to the static geometry. Here again is the full conformal diagram for two-dimensional de Sitter space. For two-dimensional de Sitter space, we can lay out the whole thing. We don't have to ignore a sphere at every point, which is implicit. We just lay it all out. There it is. There's the two-dimensional de Sitter space, infinite past, infinite future, and the region which is covered by the static coordinates is just a diamond like this. What is the nature of that diamond? I'll tell you what the nature of that diamond is. If we had an observer moving from the bottom to the top of the diagram, along any trajectory, it doesn't matter what trajectory, then this observer can send signals to certain places, and he or she can receive signals from certain places. Where can he receive signals from? The backward light cone of this point here. Where can this observer send signals to? The forward light cone of this point. The intersection of the two of them is the set of places where the observer can receive signals from and send signals to. You always get it the same way. You go into the remote future, we find out where the observer ended, draw her backward light cone, go into the remote past, draw her remote, sorry, her future light cone, and the intersection of them is the patch, I will call it the causal patch, and it's the piece of the sitter space that's covered by the static coordinates. In fact, these series of lines here represent the static coordinates. The space-like ones are just the space-like sections, lines of constant time in those coordinates, and the other ones are lines of constant r. That kind of figure, you should get familiar with this. This little picture over here comes up time and time again, and it's simply, we saw it this morning, it was a distortion of just Minkowski space, compactified to a triangle. It's also the compactification of the causal patch of the sitter space. Now, there's not just one causal patch. You can pick any pair of points, one in the past and one in the future, and do the same thing, and we'll come to that. That's a deep symmetry of the sitter space. In fact, we're going to come to, well, no, not before, one thing I left out. This morning it was mentioned that Penrose diagrams are appropriate for radial symmetry, and that's correct. Sometimes you can illustrate things for non-spherically symmetric geometries, but generally Penrose diagrams correspond to spherically symmetric geometries. When we go to higher dimensions, two dimensions, we no longer can lay the whole thing out this way. We just have to say every point corresponds to a two-sphere or a three-sphere or a four-sphere. Now, in two dimensions, every point of a Penrose diagram corresponds to a one-sphere. What is a one-sphere? Oh, 2 points, right. They're just the 2 points, one to the left and one to the right. So we can draw the whole thing, but strictly speaking, in the strictest sense, the Penrose diagram is only half of this, and we remember that every point has an image on the other side. On the other hand, it's nice to draw the whole thing for some intuitive picturization of the whole thing. And I will do that from time to time. I will even sometimes draw higher dimensional de Sitter space this way, and leave it to your imagination how you fill in things. I'll try to do it in a way that doesn't violate the mathematical rules. All right, next question. This is the Sitter space. It's the solution of Einstein equations with a constant cosmological constant, that's redundant. What is its symmetry? The symmetry of it, well, we can figure it out. Start with a D-sphere. I'm thinking about D, capital D dimensional de Sitter space. We started with a D-sphere. That was the Euclidean section. And the symmetry of the D-sphere, we all know that. That's orthogonal transformations in D plus one dimensions. The symmetry of the two-sphere is O3. The symmetry of the three-sphere is O4, and so forth. So this is the symmetry that we started with. But then we went to one time-like direction and the rest space-like directions, and that has the effect of taking OD plus 1, of course, to Lorentz transformations in D plus 1 dimensions, or OD comma 1. These are just Lorentz transformations, and if you like, just remember that hyperboloid that we drew. The hyperboloid was embedded in D plus 1 dimensions. Right? The hyperboloid describing the de Sitter space is embedded in D plus 1 dimensions, and the Lorentz transformations on that D plus 1 dimensions, it's not a mass hyperboloid, it's a tachyonic mass hyperboloid for negative mass, and it transforms under Lorentz symmetries, and so the symmetry group is OD plus 1. Now, we're going to focus a great deal in these lectures on the quantum mechanics single, not, I shouldn't call it static patch, the word is causal patch, of a single causal patch. And there will be a theme going back and forth between thinking about the single patch physics and thinking about the global physics. So this is the symmetry, the global symmetry of the Sitter space. I can tell you something else about it. It also corresponds to a simple group which just moves the points on the infinite past and infinite future around. Now, I'll show you how that works in a minute. Okay, What about the symmetry of the static patch? Picking a static patch means picking a point in the future and a point in the past. That, in effect, breaks, having picked those points, we've broken the symmetry, the full symmetry. In particular, I'm breaking the symmetry down to the symmetry group which keeps these points fixed. That will also keep the entire static patch fixed. What is the symmetry group of the static patch? This is the ordinary symmetry group that an observer in a single patch would use to describe the symmetry of the physics. And that's easy. First of all, the static patch geometry had a rotation symmetry. Remember, there was omega d minus 2. It was basically the sphere of the horizon. The sphere of the horizon, let's go back a step. What is this geometry? Supposing you're an observer inside the static patch. You see a horizon. In this case, you're not outside the horizon. The horizon surrounds you. The horizon is all around you. I should have told you that before. The horizon is all around you, spherically symmetric all around you. And now the OD minus 1, sorry, the OD minus 1 here is just a symmetry group which rotates the sphere of the celestial sphere, the De Sitter celestial sphere around your axes. Okay, so there's an OD minus 1 that you, at the center of your own coordinates, see as a manifest symmetry. I'll call it a manifest symmetry. And you, looking out at that horizon, see that symmetry, OD minus 1. And then there's another symmetry. That symmetry, incidentally, is a symmetry which moves points along the space-like sections here. It moves them, it sort of rotates them around in the space-like sections here. The other symmetry that you have is time translation invariance. This does not look time translation invariant, but that's all right, it is. You slide points out from here into here, and that's also a symmetry. So that's the manifest symmetry of a causal patch of the De Sitter space. OD minus 1 cross time. That leaves over some generators. We had OD plus 1, or OD1, as the full symmetry. The manifest symmetry was the smaller symmetry here. That must mean that there's a remaining set of generators which move around these points, or move around the static patch, which take the static patch into other static patches. You can count them. You work out the number of generators of OD1. You work out the generators of OD minus 1 cross time. You count them up. And the number of missing generators, the number of non-manifest, let's call them non-manifest symmetries of the physics, is twice d minus 1. Okay. Now,
what's the time symmetry in OD1?
Say it again?
What is the time transfer
symmetry? Oh, well, let's go, in OD plus 1?
Yeah.
Just the rotation of the sphere. Which takes one longitude to another longitude. You just rotate the Earth out from under you. So that's all it is. Remember, time was longitude in this. So it was just, Greenwich goes to whatever. I don't know. Sorry, I've lost my thread. Yes. There are two d minus 1 symmetries, which are symmetries of the full geometry, but which one static observer in his own coordinate system here would not find to be manifestly obvious symmetries of his world. They would be symmetries which related one observer to other observers, or two pairs of points to two other pairs of points. Now, the dimensionality of this surface up here, it's just a sphere. It's d minus 1 dimensional. It's a d minus 1 dimensional sphere up here and a d minus 1 dimensional sphere down here. Think about moving around points up on the top sphere here. That's a group, all right, moving points up around on the top here, and it has d minus 1 generators. The group on the bottom also has d minus 1 generators. The two d minus 1 generators here are simply the set of points, or simply the set of generators. You can divide them up in the following way. Think about all symmetries of the full space which keep the bottom point fixed and move the top point. There's d minus one of them. And think of all symmetries which keep the top point fixed and move the bottom one around. So, and obviously, if you move the top point around, you take the causal patch and you move it, you take it out of its original position to a new position, and it's a highly non-trivial symmetry of the observer's physics. We're going to talk about it more, but that's the character of the symmetries of the De Sitter space. Oh, here I have a picture. Here's a picture of having moved the top point. The bottom point I left right at the middle here, the top point I moved over to here, and the new static patch, or the new causal patch, is the intersection of the past light cone of this point with the future light cone of that point. And you see explicitly that that has had the effect of moving the static or the causal patch. The horizon, the actual horizon, now let's remember now that we actually are living in higher dimensions. The actual horizon, if this were 2 plus 1 dimensions, would be a line, not a pair of points. And that line, these light cones would intersect on the horizon, the place where the forward light cone of the past observer and the future... the forward light cone of the past observer and the backward light cone of the future observer. Did you get that? Yeah. The place where they intersect is the horizon in the sense of R equals 2mg. We'll also call these surfaces here are also extended horizons. All causal patches are equivalent. By that I mean there's a symmetry. These extra twice d minus 1 symmetries can move you from any causal patch to any other causal patch.
Well,
what if you try to move it all the ways over? Good. Okay, let's, I think,